Scotland and health trusts and ambulance services are declaring critical incidents. A Department for Health and Social Care spokesperson showed no sign of a change in approach in a recent statement, which said more than 1 million NHS workers had received a minimum £1,400 pay rise this year. The spokesman said, "We have accepted the recommendations of the independent NHS pay review body in full and have given over 1 million NHS workers a pay rise of at least £1,400 this year. This is on top of a 3% pay increase last year when public sector pay was frozen and wider government support with the cost of living." Nursing staff from more than 50 NHS trusts in England are set to take industrial action in the coming days. Moreover, the Royal College of Nursing has announced that the next strike is likely to be on 6th of February to coincide with the 10th anniversary of the Robert Francis inquiry into the Mid-Staffordshire NHS Trust and the impact of nursing shortages on patient mortality. The Robert Francis inquiry, which was focused on Mid-Staffordshire NHS Trust, uncovered the neglect of hundreds of patients at Stafford Hospital between 2005 and 2009, with accounts of some elderly people being left lying in their own beds, unable to either eat or drink. The union initially demanded a pay rise of 19%, though that has indicated it may accept 10%. Number 10 Downing Street is instead considering a one-off payment to healthcare workers, possibly in the form of a hardship payment, to get them through this winter. Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. The University and College Union, UCU, said on Thursday, 12th of January, more than 70,000 staff at 150 universities across the United Kingdom will strike for 18 days between February and March in disputes over pay, working conditions and pensions. The University and College Union General Secretary Joe Grady said, "The clock is now ticking for the sector to produce a deal or be hit with widespread disruption throughout spring." The union, which represents academics, trainers, librarians and professional staff in colleges and universities, said it was demanding better pay after employers set a pay rise worth 3% following more than a decade of below-inflation pay awards. The British government is set to unveil strike legislation in the near future to contain industrial action in its key sectors, forcing the staff to maintain a basic level of services during strike time or face dismissal.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Israel is experiencing unprecedented mass protests. Tens of thousands of Israelis have hit the streets in several cities, including Tel Aviv, Al-Quds and Haifa, for the second consecutive week to protest against plans by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to implement changes to Israel's legal system and weaken the Supreme Court. The demonstration presents an early challenge to Netanyahu and his far-right minister Etmar Ben-Gvir, was ordered police to take tough action if protesters block roads or display Palestinian flags. In defiance of Ben-Gavir's call, some footage showed Palestinian flags on display. The crowd in Tel Aviv swelled to more than 80,000 people despite rainy weather there. Demonstrators, many covered by umbrellas, held signs and chanted slogans like criminal government or the end of democracy. But what were they protesting that gave way to such a large crowd to come out?
We would like to say that the current coalition in Israel would like to change the regime to make us like a dark regime in the world, and we will not accept it and will fight for this democracy.
The focus of the protests was how the new coalition cabinet, headed by Netanyahu, wants to decrease the power of the Supreme Courts in its own favor. This as Netanyahu is trying to escape charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. The situation has already angered Israeli officials, including the president. Herzog also warned that Israel faced, quote, a historic constitutional crisis over the contested judicial reform plan. But despite all that criticism, Netanyahu has pledged to complete legislating the reforms in a way that will correct what needs correcting, totally protect individual rights, as he claims, and restore the public's faith in the justice system that so much requires such reform. The legal changes could help Netanyahu evade eviction of corruption or even make his trial disappear entirely. Office for more than just 2 weeks, Benjamin Netanyahu's right-wing cabinet has launched proposals to weaken the Supreme Court by giving parliament the power to overturn court decisions with a simple majority vote. It also wants to give parliament control over the appointment of judges and reduce the independence of legal advisors. Israeli opposition leaders, former attorneys general, and the president of Israel's Supreme Court have all spoken out against the plan. They said a move would cripple judicial independence, foster corruption, set back minority rights, and deprive Israel's courts of credibility that helps fend off war crimes abroad. Critics said the changes could help Netanyahu evade conviction in his corruption trial or make the trial disappear altogether. But are these protests against Netanyahu himself? Netanyahu's premiership in the past has been fraught not only with trying to escape corruption charges, but also violations like Palestinian rights, settlement construction, and other hot-button issues that exist between Palestinians and Israel. Inside Israel, the opposition against the current right-wing cabinet and Netanyahu is so high and elevated that a new movement has been created to promote and encourage Israelis to leave Israel, with a group planning to move 10,000 Israeli Jews in the first stage of its project. Meanwhile, grassroots Palestinians with no affiliation to any of the resistance groups are rising against the regime. Den of Lions is one, an independent armed Palestinian group operating in the Israeli-occupied West Bank. In the meantime, the current right-wing cabinet and its far-right minister Ben-Gavir are advocating more violence against Palestinians, which would lead to more deaths, including violations like settlement buildings, changing the demographics of Al-Aqsa and Al-Quds, and other core issues. The cost of living is one other major issue protesters are angry with. After all, Israel is expensive and has one of the highest costs of living in the world. With all the crises the regime is grappling with, what seems to be on the corner for officials in Tel Aviv is what a protester said during the Saturday demonstration. "I came here to demonstrate against the anti-democratic steps of the new cabinet. This can be the start of the end of the Jewish state as we know it. Is this cabinet igniting the start of the end of Israel?" This exactly signifies what former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak expressed concern about, the survival of Israel. Barak said the entity will cease to exist before the 80th anniversary of its 1948 establishment. He said throughout the Jewish history, the Jews did not rule for more than 80 years, except in the two kingdoms of David and the Hasmonean dynasty, and in both periods, their disintegration began in the 8th decade. The United States and yet again, racially motivated killings happening on a record number. The tragic death of Keenan Darnell Anderson after he was tased by police officers in Los Angeles following a car accident has sparked outrage. Anderson, 31, cousin of a co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement, Patrice Cullors, died at a hospital in Santa Monica, California, after suffering a cardiac arrest following the crash on the afternoon of January 3rd in a Los Angeles neighborhood. Anderson was repeatedly tased by Los Angeles police officers and restrained following the accident. In a 13-minute body cam footage released by Los Angeles Police Department, Anderson is seen begging for help as multiple officers hold him to the ground and one officer presses his elbow along with his body weight onto his neck.
Stop it, I'm gonna tase you.
Then Anderson can be heard, "They're trying to George Floyd me," referring to African-American man George Floyd, who was killed at the hands of the U.S. police in May 2020 in Minneapolis, sparking racial justice protests around the world. In the footage, Anderson shouts, "They're trying to kill me," asking others for help. After the incident, paramedics arrived at the scene and took him to a hospital, where according to the police, he went into cardiac arrest, which caused his death. Now, Patrice Cullors, who herself co-founded the Black Lives Matter movement, says her cousin was asking for help and he didn't receive it. She said he was killed, adding that nobody deserves to die in fear, panicking and scared for their life. Cullors noted her cousin was scared for his life, stressing that he spent the last 10 years witnessing a movement challenging the killing of black people. He knew what was at stake and he was trying to protect himself. Nobody was willing to protect him. Anderson's killing is the third such incident linked to the Los Angeles police in the first days of 2023. On January 2nd, police fatally shot 45-year-old Tucker Smith, and a day after, police fired on a 35-year-old Oscar Sanchez. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has called the incidents deeply disturbing, adding that we must reduce the use of force overall, and I have absolutely no tolerance for excessive force. The latest police violence highlights alarming proportions in the U.S. in recent years, with people of color being the main targets. A 2021 study recorded 30,800 deaths from the police violence across the U.S. between 1980 and 2018, far higher than estimates offered by the National Vital Statistics System. The study said more than 55 deaths of such incidents in the U.S. from 1980 to 2018 were misclassified or unreported in official vital statistics reports. Meanwhile, according to new data released earlier this month, U.S. police killed at least 1,176 people in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record for police violence in the country since experts first started tracking the killings. The killing of Keenan Darnell Anderson takes numerous matters into the spotlight. First and foremost is how U.S. officials reacted to the incident. 31-year-old father and English teacher, who is an African-American, killed by LAPD police. The cause, cardiac arrest after being repeatedly tased by the police. Anderson is the cousin of Black Lives Matter movement Patrice Cullors, but still no major word or reaction from anyone within the establishment. Two, could this death by any means be prevented? Cullors say this was a traffic accident. Instead of treating Anderson like a potential criminal, police could have called the ambulance. If there was a policy in which traffic stops were met with unarmed professionals who come to the scene to help with whatever situation has happened, that would have prevented my cousin's death, and that would have prevented so many other deaths. The other matter that has to be taken into account is how he was killed. One officer had his elbow on Anderson's neck while he was lying down before another tased him for roughly 30 seconds straight before pausing and tasing him again for 5 more seconds. The other point is LAPD not calling it a killing. It instead calls it an in-custody death. Apart from the ambiguity of the phrase, Keen was tased to death. Everyone knows LAPD caused Keenan's death. Cullors say these types of killing and this type of force will not be interrupted unless we have courageous elected officials come forward and challenge not just the police, but also the policies. One other factor is that the incident marks the third officer-involved death in the city this year. From 1980 to 2018, more than 30,000 people have died by police violence in the United States, according to a 22 article published in The Lancet. U.S. police killing 3 people a day, and no progress since George Floyd. Based on figures released by Mapping Police Violence, police have killed roughly 1,100 people each year since 2013. In 2021, officers killed 1,136 people, one of the deadliest years on record. National data has shown that roughly 10% of the killings by police each year starts with a traffic encounter, and that 1 in 3 people killed were fleeing before lethal force was used. What about police brutality and racial bias? Why are there more cases of police brutality against African Americans or people of color than whites? By one estimate, black people are 2.5 times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. In another study, black people who were fatally shot by police seem to be twice as likely as white people to be unarmed. Based on information from more than 2 million 911 calls in 2 U.S. cities, it can be concluded that white officers dispatched to black neighborhoods fire their guns 5 times as often as black officers dispatched for similar calls to the same neighborhoods. The Washington Post reports lawsuits to settle allegations of misconduct by more than 7,600 officers from around the country have amounted to more than $3.2 billion over the past decade. All in all, what seems to be a very high urgency is that U.S. police treatment of African Americans needs an overhaul. If not, more and more people like Keenan Darnell Anderson will fall victim to the U.S. police brutality, and officers involved killing will be sharply on the rise.
The Oxfam report analyzed 1,727 attacks on Yemeni civilians since the start of 2021. The report finds that at least 839 civilians were killed and 1,775 others were wounded during this time. 87 of the deaths were caused by airstrikes alone. The aircrafts used in the attacks, over half of them British-made, used cluster bombs, the use of which is banned by international law. The rest of the killings were done through artillery strikes, missile barrages, drone attacks, landmines, road bombs, and the use of light arms. According to another report by an American think tank, The American Thinker, Saudi Arabia spends some $200 million per day on the war to hire mercenaries and maintain the arms supply. A large portion of this money goes to the UK for purchasing Typhoon and Tornado aircrafts, Paveway bombs and Brimstone and Storm Shadow missiles, making the UK fully complicit in the crimes committed against Yemeni civilians. As stated by the International Development Committee of the UK, given that the UK has a long history of defense exports to Saudi Arabia and its coalition partners, and considering the evidence we have heard, it seems inevitable that any violations of international humanitarian and human rights law by the coalition have involved arms supplied from the UK. These arms have also been used by the Saudi-led coalition to bomb health facilities on 19 separate instances, which constitutes war crimes. Oxfam's policy advisor Martin Butcher called on the UK government to immediately cease its arms sales to the Saudis. He also pointed out the hypocrisy of UK sanctions against Russia over alleged war crimes in Ukraine, all the while turning a blind eye to the blatant war crimes of the Saudi coalition in Yemen. Not only that, but he also pointed out to the fact that the UK government still continues to sell arms to Saudi Arabia, being its second biggest arms supplier, which will be inevitably used in the war against Yemen. Butcher also said they, the government, have really been not only arming Saudi Arabia, but also very reluctant to use their position in the Security Council to push for peace. Saudi Arabia is the biggest importer of arms in the world, second only to a country with 40 times the population. In the year 2020 alone, the kingdom imported nearly $1 billion worth of arms, the majority of which came from the U.S. This, however, does not stop the U.S. from parroting a tired narrative of pushing for peace in Yemen when they even hesitate to call it a war. This is apparent by Biden's initial pledges to end the war during his presidential campaign while still supplying arms to the kingdom to this day. Here's Timothy Lender King, U.S. Special Envoy to Yemen.
Let me begin first by reiterating our commitment, the commitment of the United States, to helping improve Yemeni lives, creating the space for Yemenis to collectively determine their own future, and to advance a durable resolution that ends the conflict in Yemen.
All the while, the weapon fragments bearing U.S. and U.K. branding paints a starkly different picture. The 6 months UN-sponsored truce that was supposed to be the grounds for longer-standing solutions was also very quickly and repeatedly violated by Saudi Arabia. This is what Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement sees as the reason for the temporary truce. The Saudi-led coalition's main goal out of the truce was to stop the Houthi Ansarullah forces from carrying out retaliatory military operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia. Moreover, the crippling sea, land, and air blockade on Yemen has created a humanitarian disaster in the country. With all options exhausted, the Ansarullah movement has now said that it will inevitably launch missile strikes deep inside Saudi and UAE territories. This comes amid reports that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is looking to find a way out of the incredibly costly Yemen war. The Lebanese Al-Akhbar newspaper wrote, "Riyadh is now showing a lot of flexibility during negotiations. It currently has no concern other than getting security guarantees that strategic facilities deep inside the country would not be hit. It has abandoned the illusion of turning Yemen into a country under its tutelage and has instead sufficed for security assurances." However, this report needs more confirmation. While the Saudi coalition has indeed failed in its attempts to strangle Yemen into submission, their aggression still caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen.
Since the war broke out in Ukraine and Western countries rushed to help Ukraine against Russia, they provided Ukraine with different types of weapons in a bid to prevent Russia's rapid military advance. But it has now turned out that the war has been a unique opportunity for Western arms manufacturers to make a profit. According to a report based on data from the Defense News and TradingView Analytics, major Western arms manufacturers involved in military supplies to Ukraine earned $124 billion last year. According to estimates, the corporation's combined market capitalization increased from $579 billion in December 2021 to $703 billion in December 2022. The ranking included 25 companies with a capitalization of over $1 billion, which are traded on the stock market and have military products dominating their revenues. These companies are actively involved in arms supplies to Ukraine. German arms manufacturer Rheinmetall has been the top gainer over the last 12 months. Its share price has surged 122%. Another notable example is French drone and missile producer Thales, whose stock value rose by 54%. American military contractor Northrop Grumman was up 44%, and the stock of HIMARS rocket launchers maker Lockheed Martin gained 42%. Other notable mentions in the report include BAE Systems, Kongsberg, Gruppen, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies.
Rather than continuing to build up offensive capability by transferring weapons from the American side to the Ukrainian side, which enriches American defense contractors and only allows more Ukrainians and more Russians to bleed, more and more weapons will eventually lead to an escalation of the war, and that is extremely dangerous.
The report comes amid increasing military support for Ukraine. In 2022, the Biden administration committed more than $19 billion in military aid to Ukraine. It's set to give Ukraine another $45 billion in 2023. Washington is now seeking to deliver Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. The U.S. is now set to train scores of Ukrainian troops on how to deploy and maintain the American Patriot missile systems.
The training will prepare approximately 90 to 100 Ukrainian soldiers to operate, maintain, and sustain the defensive system over a training course expected to last several months. And once fielded, the Patriot will continue to contribute to Ukraine's air defense capabilities and provide another capability to the Ukrainian people to defend themselves against Russia's ongoing aerial assaults.
The Kremlin has said the systems and any crews accompanying them would be legitimate priority targets for the Russian military. The U.S. is now contemplating delivering Stryker armored vehicles to Ukraine as part of a new Pentagon shipment. Furthermore, the U.K. announced that it would provide Ukraine with main battle tanks, and Poland said it would transfer a company of Leopard 2 Panzers to Kiev. Germany has, however, to greenlight Poland's re-export of the hardware. Germany says it will follow the U.S. President Joe Biden's lead on whether to support Kiev with Leopard 2 main battle tanks. Germany has faced mounting pressure to provide Ukraine with Leopard 2 tanks, but has been reluctant to do so. Russia has repeatedly warned Western countries against sending arms to Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly warned the West against flooding Ukraine with weapons. It insists that sending more weapons to Ukraine will only prolong the war, while prompting the Kiev forces to kill civilians in the pro-Moscow regions.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
This week in occupied Palestine, the new Zionist government entered its second week in office, introducing a ban on Palestinian flags being displayed in public settings and ordering them to be taken down. Although the Zionist regime's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's face-off with the Israeli opposition was a main headline grabber, the primary issue has been the frequent and violent raids against Palestinians in the West Bank, leading to the murder of more Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Recently, the Zionist regime gunboats opened fire in the morning on fishermen in their boats off the Al-Sudania area in northern Gaza. That's according to the website of Palestine Chronicle. This website added, in the West Bank, occupation forces prevented Palestinians from reaching the Bir Harris area to secure settler incursions. The Zionist media reported that the sanctions that the Israeli government had announced against the Ramallah base, Palestinian Authority were designed to not target key figures with the PA. The Zionist regime sanctions against the Palestinian Authority revoked the VIP access status for some PA officials, excluding PA president and other leaders of the security services. The Zionist regime occupation forces were targeted with bullets near Tarsala al-Makalla settlement, east of Jenin, as the Jenin Brigade's armed groups opened fire towards the location. In Masafer Yatta, a collection of villages located in southern hills of Al-Khalil, two Palestinians were injured by the Zionist regime military. Orthodox Christmas celebrations also took place inside the Gaza Strip. Zionist settlers later destroy 40 olive trees in Khalet al-Ramrim area, east of Al-Ghilia. Statistics were also released revealing that 233 Palestinian political prisoners have died inside Zionist regime military prisons since 1967. In acts of resistance, Palestinians set fire to a military post in Hawara near Nablus, while protesters in Al-Khalil came under attack by the Zionist regime occupation forces, later throwing a homemade explosive at a nearby military checkpoint. Also, Zionist settlers beat up a woman in an unprovoked attack in Khalet al-Nahla, Beit Lahm, while a group of Zionist settlers attacked Palestinian-owned vehicles. A roughly 40,000-strong demonstration of Israelis also against Netanyahu marched through Tel Aviv and started a round of political bickering between opposing Zionist political parties. Aram neighborhood in Al-Quds was also stormed by Israeli regime forces. Also, according to Palestine Chronicle, Israeli regime navy boats attacked Gazan fishermen using a skunk water cannon, while in Al-Quds, the Israeli regime occupation police forced their way into Al-Qibli Mosque at Al-Aqsa compound. Zionist settlers also stormed the site. Also, young Palestinian men threw an ineffective homemade explosive at Al-Jamali checkpoint northeast of Jenin. Clashes between the Zionist regime military and young people with stones broke out over the detention of Ahad Khalil, who has been held by the fabricated regime of Israel for 2 years. The demonstration took place in Beit Omar, north of Al-Khalil. Two shootings were also reported from a distance targeting Karmizur illegal settlement, which is built on the lands of Beit Omar north of Al-Khalil.
Zionist settlers in the northern West Bank protested after shootings towards settlements escalate, urging the army to do something. The occupation forces stormed Al-Maqasid Hospital in the town of Atur, east of occupied Al-Quds in Al-Isawiya, while areas surrounding Jenin, Nablus, Ramallah and Tulkarm were also raided by the Zionist regime forces. Also recently, despite the provocations at Al-Aqsa Mosque, the regimes from the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, Egypt and the US sent officials to meet together with their Zionist counterparts in preparation for a second multilateral summit. While this occurred, Zionist settlers stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mahran Abu Saif, 39, was shot dead in occupied city of Jaffa that morning, adding to an already tense situation for Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories. It is widely believed that the Zionist regime police turn a blind eye to the crime in Palestinian neighborhoods and that in some cases they even collaborate with Zionist gangs that plague their communities. 1,200 Palestinians in the West Bank were then made aware that soon they will be deported and that their homes will undergo demolition in Masafer Yatta al-Khalil. This year has also marked 18 years since PA was elected. He was prevented all national elections since the landslide win in 2006 in the legislative elections. Zionist settlers also attacked the home and destroyed Palestinian vehicles recently in Khalayel al-Zuu area, south of Beit Lahm. Palestinians in Galgilia also threw stones at Zionist settler vehicles. The Zionist regime forces also brutally beat a young Palestinian man in Silwan, East Al-Quds, which was caught on camera. An explosion then rocked an Israeli regime military base in the northern West Bank. While no injuries were reported, an entire room was blown up. An IED then exploded at a separation wall near infamous Qalandia checkpoint, damaging the wall. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported Palestinian farmers in south of West Bank prevented by Zionist regime troops from plowing their lands. Palestinian farmers in the village of Burin in south of West Bank were prevented by the Zionist regime troops from plowing their lands, according to a local activist. Rateb Al-Jabour, active in the settlement and wall resistance group, told Wafa News Agency that the Zionist regime troops raided the village and forced villagers plowing their 15 dunam land from continuing their work. He said the illegal Zionist settlement of Bani Hefer is built on Burin land and most likely the settlement intends to expand at the expense of more of the Palestinian village lands.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Men and women as human beings are completely equal in Islam. This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, meeting with hundreds of prominent Iranian women in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on January 4, 2023. Of course, the duties of men and women are different, but there is a balance. One of the women mentioned this in her talk in the same sense, and work has been done on this. This matter has been studied. You can find details on this in books, different writings, and such. When we look at responsibilities, emphasis is placed on the natural characteristics of men and women. There are certain differences between men and women, that is, in the female nature and in the male nature. There are differences in their bodies, souls, and in spiritual matters. Their duties are in accordance with these differences. These differences have an effect on the type of responsibilities assigned to men and women. This has to do with the feminine and masculine nature. Neither gender should act in a manner that contradicts their nature. A man who resembles a woman in his behavior, facial makeup, and other things, and a woman who resembles a man in her behavior, speech, and her movements are behaving improperly. They are both behaving improperly. This was about the personal duties and the different responsibilities that exist in the home and outside the environment of the home.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
As for duties in society, the responsibilities of men and women are the same. Their roles are different, but their duties are the same. Jihad is obligatory for both men and women, but the nature of jihad that men undertake is different from the jihad that is undertaken by women. For example, during the 8-year Holy Defense War, women also had obligations. They had duties, and they performed their duties well. During that period, women performed as well as men did, if not better. If you have not done so already, I suggest you read books about the roles of women during the period of Holy Defense. A number of books have been written about them. Praise God, our youth are concerned about these things and are producing such books now. Let's say you read one of the books that tells the story of one of the wives of the martyrs. I doubt you will be able to read one of these biographies without shedding tears while reading it. It is impossible.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
During the eight-year war and aggression against Yemen, the aggressor Saudi-led coalition has completely demolished 162 health centers in Yemen and partially destroyed 375 medical centers. During this period, 66 medical personnel were martyred by direct bombing of the aggressor coalition and 70 ambulances have been destroyed. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Ansar Allah news website has covered this story and tells us more. Yemen's Ministry of Health warned of a human catastrophe that threatens the lives of more than 5,000 patients with renal failure as a result of the years-long Saudi-led blockade against the impoverished nation. Ali Jahaf, National Salvation Government's Deputy Health Minister, made the remark at a press conference in the Yemeni capital Sana'a late on Saturday, 14th of January, as he raised the alarm about the depletion of the stock of dialysis drugs and medicine for Yemeni patients suffering from chronic kidney failure. Ali Jahaf added, "This is not the first conference, and we have held more than one. We have been warning of a human catastrophe threatening the lives of thousands of dialysis patients in various governorates, but there is no response." He added, "We have addressed the United Nations and health organizations operating in Yemen that we need to provide sufficient drug stocks for dialysis sessions for the year 2023, as we need approximately 500,000 dialysis sessions every year without receiving a response despite loss of correspondence and meetings in this regard." Stressing that dialysis centers in Yemen are standing on the verge of collapse, Ali Jahaf said, "The issue will affect the lives of 5,000 patients with kidney failure who need dialysis sessions and drugs, and they may lose their lives if these solutions and medicines are not available urgently." Yemen's Deputy Health Minister underscored the importance of opening Sana'a Airport and yet the Yemeni port of Hodeidah, as they are vital outlets for medicine and food for millions of Yemenis in the besieged areas of the country. The Deputy Health Minister of Yemen added, "In light of the imposed blockade, we are unable as a country to import vital medicines and save our patients." Ali Jahaf went on to say, "We are in urgent need within 2 weeks to provide dialysis sessions and our stock of medicines has run out." Anis al-Asbahi, a spokesman for Yemen's Ministry of Health, also called on international organizations to urgently provide dialysis sessions so that dialysis centers in Yemen would continue to operate and save the lives of patients. Anis al-Asbahi held the United Nations responsible for saving the lives of dialysis patients and responding to the basic requirements of the Yemeni people who are currently under a Saudi-imposed siege, stressing the need to open Sana'a Airport and the Yemeni port of Hodeidah. The website of the World Health Organization, WHO, has also covered this story. Over 8 years of war and aggression in Yemen have resulted in a massive setback to an already weak healthcare system and led to a dramatic collapse of healthcare services provided to the Yemeni population. More than 20 million people out of the total population of 30 million Yemenis require healthcare services in 2023, while only half of the health facilities are fully functioning. The dialysis centers also face a severe shortfall of essential supplies such as medication and fuel to run hospital equipment, as well as a lack of funds to pay healthcare workers regularly. Via has been working as a nurse in Al-Sadaqa Hospital's dialysis center in Aden for at least 8 years. She has witnessed the torment of kidney failure patients and the decreasing capacity of the hospital to treat the patients properly. Via said, "Without dialysis, consumables and supplies, the suffering of these patients is unbearable. But because of the lack of medical supplies, we often had no other choice than to reduce the duration or the frequency of the dialysis sessions." Dr. Abdul Wahab Al-Nehmi, non-communicable disease officer at the World Health Organization country office in Yemen, said, "Limited access to dialysis sessions and treatment puts the lives of these vulnerable patients at higher risk, not to mention the suffering they go through and their families through because of the lack of medical treatment." Despite the efforts of the World Health Organization, WHO, and non-governmental organizations in coordination with health authorities in Yemen, significant gaps remain due to funding shortages and because of a lack of a humanitarian response in Yemen. Continued support is needed to save the lives of the most vulnerable people in Yemen, including patients who are suffering from renal failure. China's Xinhua news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Health officials in Yemen's capital Sana'a have warned that over 5,000 renal failure patients are at risk of death because there may not be enough essential supplies to keep local dialysis centers going. Fear and anxiety ran rampant in the renal disease ward of the Al-Thoura Hospital in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, which provided dialysis treatment for hundreds of patients every day. According to Hamdan Salamin, the hospital's deputy director, a severe shortage of medical supplies is the most pressing problem at the dialysis center in the hospital. He warned that if the center runs out of supplies, it may have to close, which is expected to happen soon. Ali Al-Ezi, one of the patients, said, "The closure of the dialysis center will be a great tragedy for the renal disease patients like him." Ali Al-Ezi complained while taking his dialysis. He said, "Life has been already very difficult in Yemen. Our salaries were cut for years and the price of medical treatment and medicine is soaring. Many of us had to sell our possessions to obtain the required medical treatments." Ali Al-Ezi said, "Now it is a matter of life and death now. If we can't get access to our treatment, we will die." Grinding into its 8th year, the Yemen war has ravaged more than half of the country's health facilities, cut off wages, reduced imports, caused serious shortages of medical supplies throughout the country, and pushed more than 20 million Yemenis to the brink of famine. The Ansar Allah movement's health authorities released a statement recently stating that hospitals in the capital Sana'a and the regions under their control will run out of medical supplies and other essential supplies for renal disease treatment by the beginning of 2023. Salamin said public hospitals are the last resort for many renal disease patients in the war-torn country because the majority of them could not afford to go to private health clinics. He added, "We call on the international community for urgent help so that we could find a solution and save the lives of thousands of Yemenis." Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with its Arab allies and with arms and logistics support from the United States and other Western countries, has launched a devastating war on Yemen in March of 2015. The objective was to crush the Ansar Allah resistance movement in Yemen, which has been running the country ever since.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
We attended a press conference held by Yemen's Ministry of Health in Sana'a, where it was declared that the Saudi-imposed blockade is causing a national health crisis by preventing entry of medicines and equipment for kidney failure patients. In the absence of dialysis treatment, approximately 5,000 patients on dialysis are at risk of dying, according to the health ministry.
The Saudi-led coalition targeted the health and medical sector from the very beginning of the war by directly destroying medical facilities, centers, hospitals, and medicine warehouses, and by imposing a blockade on every aspect of life through this siege that is being backed by America in order to control the country's health system.
Khaled Ahmed is one of the patients on dialysis, who is currently getting treatment at Athoda Hospital. He said the lack of supplies has prevented him and other patients from receiving the required number of dialysis treatments per week.
We cannot eat much because we are only receiving two dialysis treatments a week instead of the required three treatments. As a result, we can only eat a bare minimum food.
But getting the required three treatments per week for Gayed and the other 5,000 patients like him is a near impossible task these days. This mixed solution, which is used to operate the dialysis machine, is in very short supply. There's only enough for two more weeks.
It's gotten so bad that we have to close down this section simply because we do not have enough supplies to run all of the dialysis machines. If we opened this section, we would have no more supplies to treat patients. We've had to make emergency requests to other dialysis clinics to provide us with such equipment. By the end of January, we will be forced to close down because we'll have no more supplies to operate.
Unless the Kidney Disease Center at Athoda Hospital is supplied with dialysis filters and the solution needed to operate dialysis machines, they will be forced to shut down by the end of January. If that happens, the lives of approximately 5,000 patients will be at risk. The Yemeni army has repeatedly warned that if the Saudi-imposed blockade is not lifted, it would be forced to take military action. The siege must be ended so that much-needed medicine and other essential supplies can enter the country. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol visited the United Arab Emirates this week to boost trade ties. South Korea is constructing four nuclear reactors for the UAE as President Yoon supports a return to nuclear energy.
Korea has also declared its 2050 carbon neutrality goal. To achieve this goal, we're working to rapidly restore the nuclear power system, which supplies carbon-free electricity, and boost the supply of clean energy, such as renewable energy and hydrogen energy.
President Yoon also seeks to boost weapons exports to the UAE on the heels of a $3.5 billion deal for a South Korean anti-ballistic missile system. This despite a controversial surveillance lapse in South Korea. President Yoon and the South Korean military have been under intense criticism following a recent incursion of five North Korean drones across the border. President Yoon and his wife Sunday visited a detachment of South Korean soldiers stationed in the UAE since 2011. South Korea has become a major arms exporter of fighter jets, tanks, and guided missiles, which have found prominent use in the war in Yemen. South Koreans, however, view such weapon sales with caution.
It's good to sell weapons in terms of earning foreign currency through our export,